I'm very pleased to introduce again Professor Mikael Actor from the University of Southern Denmark, who's teaches in the Study of Religions department there, and has expertise in Mimamsa and other aspects of Hinduism. And today he's talking to us about the Panchayatana Puja and its revival in Tamil Nadu.
Thank you so much. Yeah, what you see here is the Panchayatana Puja, the five stones, and some more things I will be talking about. And this is in the very it's a very fine, very kind couple, the Atreyas, in Mylapore, Chennai, which I visited and was part of the puja. The Panchayatana Puja is a puja of five gods, in the form of five stones or figurines, or a combination of stones and figurines, like you see here. There are some classical rules about how these stones or figurines should be oriented. This one is the Shiva Panchayatana Puja with the linga in the center. What people place in the center can depend on many things. It can be a family tradition, or it can depend on the year. For instance, the Panchayatana Puja that I witnessed was at the end of the Navaratri, and therefore it was Devi who was in the center. The classical Panchayatana Puja, do I have a picture of that? No, I don't. I think just a moment. I wonder. Yeah. The classical Panchayatana Puja orientation, if it's the Shiva Panchayatana Puja, will be like this, with Shiva in the middle. I will just have to take it in the right sequence. No, let's see it. Let's first learn about each of the stones. We have the Banalinga, which is Shiva, and which is any stone of an evil oval shape from the Narmada River near, mostly near Omkareshwar. The Shalagrama, which is Vishnu, which is an ammonite fossil from the Gandaki River in northern Nepal, around the city of Muktinath. Then there's Patika, Surya, which is a roundly cut quartz crystal, ideally from around the town Vellam, which is near Tanjavur in Tamil Nadu. And then the Shonabhadra, representing Ganesh, around red. It can be jasper, or it can be laterite or other red stones, ideally from the Son River in Bihar. And then finally the Suvarnamukhi, which is Ambika, a pyrite, that is a certain crystal, iron sulfate crystal, and ideally collected from the Suvarnamukhi River near Sri Kalahastri in Andhra Pradesh. When I write ideally for the three latter stones, that is because these locations are mentioned in when people talk about the puja, that the stone should ideally be collected at these places. The stones are not found there. I mean, the Banalingas are still collected at the Narmada River, and the Shalagrama are still collected in Nepal around Muktinath. But the three other stones are not found at these places anymore. Actually, it is so that according to tradition, the stones should only be transmitted from father to son, or within the family, and it's not good to buy or sell the stones. But the actual practice today is actually to buy the stones, because in many families the ritual has died out, especially in northern India, whereas in the southern India and in Tamil Nadu it is more alive, and it has there's been a revival these years to reintroduce the ritual. And for these families who do not have the stones from the fathers or grandfathers, they will have to go and buy them, and that would be done in one of the big puja shops in Chennai. So this is the classical orientation. If it's the Shiva Panchayatana Puja with Shiva in the center, Vishnu top left, and Surya top right, Ganesha bottom right, and Devi bottom left. These rules of, and depending on which god is in the center, the orientation will shift. These rules are based on a verse attributed to one Bhopadeva, who are quoted in several texts from the 17th, 18th century. The ritual procedure, according to the Nityanikam, the daily routine of every Brahmin, which is a popular Sanskrit manual of daily rituals for Brahmins, it describes the ritual as a puja, including the 16 upacharas, the 16 services like bathing, feeding, dressing the deities, etc. So the stones, for instance, are dressed by binding a small piece of cloth around each, and also a string representing the Yajnapavita, except, of course, Devi. A particular point in the procedure deserves special mention. Whereas most mantras during the ritual address the deities rather than the stones that constitute their material forms, the invocations, which is the first of the 16 upacharas, explicitly mention these stone forms. Each deity is invoked first by a Vedic verse and subsequently by a direct invocation of the deity in each stone. And I quote, "I focus my thought on, I invoke Mahaganapati in this material image, Asmin Bimbe. I focus my thought on, I invoke Shiva united with his consort Uma and his son Skanda in this Linga, Asmin Linga. I focus my thought on, I invoke Ambika in this material image, Asmin Bimbe. I focus my thought on, I invoke Mahavishnu united with his consort Bhumi in this Shalagrama discus, Asmin Shalagrama Chakre. I focus my thought on, I invoke Surya Narayana united with his consort Chaya and Sandhya in the material image of this crystal, Asmin Spatika Bimbe." So there we have a direct mentioning of the objects. But the invocations are somewhat contradictory. According to medieval sources, neither the Shalagrama nor the Banalanga requires invocation. Both are considered direct and permanent manifestation of the respective gods, unlike temporary forms of, say, clay or earth, and also unlike artifacts made by humans, such as images in the temples or those on the domestic altar, which have to go through a formal consecration and invocation at the time of establishment. There is an unequal distribution of textual material for these stones. There are a lot of texts on the Shalagrama, Puranic texts and other texts, a good deal on the Banalinga, and almost nothing on the three remaining stones. This unequal distribution of textual material might indicate that the Panchayana Puja was grafted onto an already existing culting use of the Shalagrama and the Banalinga. Of the five stones, these two are the most extraordinary. One a fossil with characteristic marks not found on other stones, and the other originating from, in topographic term, a very special source. The cultural awareness and cultic use of extraordinary stones are acknowledged as elements of prehistoric practice. And even without archaeological finds, it seems reasonable to hypothesize that these two stones would have been used ritually by local people from the two respective areas long before the creation of any textual or epigraphic evidence of such use. Temple architecture indicates that an arrangement with one main deity in the center and four others in each surrounding corner of a square platform, the so-called Panchayatana temple type, started to appear after the decline of the Gupta Empire, the earliest preserved examples being some temples from the 6th century or so. This reorganization of temple architecture and worship was a smarter response to the collapse of the old order and the social disruption that followed. It was an attempt to create an inclusive base for pan-Indian religious unity in the midst of growing sectarian fragmentation. The idea was further systematized and emphasized by Shankara, and in more recent years it has been a consistent idea put forth by Smartas that he was the first to promote the Panchayatana Puja. At the very least, it is in Shankara's work that we find the first clear textual reference to the Shalagrama stone as the seat of Vishnu. With the Panchayatana structure already in place in temple architecture and ritual, and one of the five stones explicitly mentioned in his work, it is possible that the Panchayatana Puja became established as a Smarta ritual during the time of Shankara. However, we lack definitive evidence. The tradition may have been established centuries later, but with reference to Shankara as a means of legitimation. The modern revival of the ritual in Chennai takes place among certain groups of Smarta Brahmins in Chennai, and I'm not sure how far spread this is among Smartas in Chennai. The group I've been working with is perhaps a particular group, and it is centered around this man called Sharma Shastrigal. I'm not sure of the Tamil pronunciation. Do you say Sharma or Sarma?
Sharma.
Sharma Shastrigal. What we see here is his. He arranged an initiation ceremony. In advance, he and others who took this initiative selected 108 Brahmin couples who were initiated in this puja, in order to revive the puja. And these persons, these couples, were interviewed and through a procedure to be selected. Here we see them. Yeah. Okay, I will just give an account of how my research ended on this study. My research started with the history of iconography of the Shivalinga. The work has already been done brilliantly by iconographers such as T.A. Gopinath Rao from 1914, and more recently by Gridley van Mittervelder. Referring to what we were talking about yesterday, this is Mittervelder's diagram of the history of the Linga iconography from the more plastic representations to more and more abstract. This is the way the linga is constructed according to tradition. What we see as a linga is only one third. Actually, the linga has to go down in the earth, and you can see the divisions of different parts of the linga. There are rules about how the shape should be, and then there are these lines that I showed you, for instance, here on this one, with the two. The two Brahma Sutras, these two lines, and then the sloping lines, the Parsha Sutras, which of course is a kind of abstraction of what we see on the first one, and then becomes more and more abstract. Okay, this was my start to got interest in the Banalingas. The Banalingas are collected here in around Unkareshwar Narmada River. And in the Narmada River we have this island, Mandata Island, where there is a small pilgrimage around the island. I walk that pilgrimage, it's not very far. It's a beautiful trip with signs with all the verses from the Bhagavad Gita all around the island. And you come past these things, you can see these stones everywhere, these Banalingas. And according to the tradition, actually there is a pilgrimage going the whole way along the river from its start to its end and back again on the other side, the Narmada Parikrama. And there is a text, a manual, an old manual of the pilgrimage, which describes the place where these Banalingas are collected. And it says, the beauty of this place must be seen with one's own eyes. It cannot be described. On the south bank stands the temple of Dhareswara Shiva. In old times, Bahanasura made 1 crore Shivalingas and worshipped them. Then he threw all the lingas he had made into the Narmada Kund. And ever since, divine Shivalingas come out of the Tavrikund. Underwater people are living there. Give them any article, and after it has gone under, they will at once make a Banalinga appear and gift it to you. The world-famous Banalingas of the Narmada come out here. Every Banalinga found in any temple of India comes from Tavrikund. This Tavrikund is actually, or was actually, underwater cave. And it was located right under a waterfall. So the combination of the waterfall and the cave made some rotating movement with shaped the stones. That ended in 2007 due to the very huge hydroelectric Narmada project and the building of the Omkareshwar Dam, which submerged the waterfall. So the process is no longer there. And therefore, since 2007, it hasn't been possible to collect the natural stones, which are, for instance, like this one. So the ritual has adjusted to these modern conditions simply by producing the Banalingas. And they are collected, suitable stones are collected. This is actually against the traditional rules, but nevertheless, they are produced now in workshops with grinders and things. Very dusty affair, like this. And then they get polished and sold, like, much more, you know, symmetric and polished than the original Banalingas. And the machines. And they can be of many different sizes. So I visited the city, but then I wanted to also to visit the village of Dharaji, with where the original waterfall was located, to find if the family who did the diving for the stones before 2007, if they were still there. And actually they were, and arranged an interview with this family. So now we go back to Dharaji. And I interviewed these two brothers, Nam Singh and Ram Singh, who were the two brothers who did the diving before 2007. The diving was monopolized on a certain one family, and it was only these two brothers who did the diving, because it actually is not it is risky to do this. The problem is that traditionally, they will dive for, you know, one, perhaps two in a day at the maximum. And then they would be given a donation. And those who approach them would be like temple trustees or other who wanted to have a Banalinga established in the temple. But since 2007, when that was not longer possible, they didn't have that sort of income. So they are actually quite poor today. I'm speaking here with Nam Singh. And here, together with both brothers and one copy of Shalagrama. In traditional Puranic texts, for instance, there is a huge tradition of how to associate certain Shalagramas, certain Banalingas to specific epithets or aspects of Shiva. This is one of the Banalingas I bought from Bakawa from the workshop, and these kind of definitions can go like this. I will not read them all, but just the last one. The Arthanarishvara Linga, with marks like the trident and the drum, is divided by one half being white and the other being red. That makes sense. And my with three dots could be a Trilochana This one, the Tilleuctena linga, is white in complexion, well, not completely, with white lines like hairs and three eye-like marks, etc. So that illustrates how what I was talking about yesterday. Also, this fluidity between the aniconic object and the iconography of the anthropomorphic gods. Okay, let's now move on to the shalagrama, which are collected in Nepal. So I moved on to Kathmandu, and around Pashupatinath there's a huge bazaar specialized in the collection and selling of the shalagramas. And again, the selling is actually not according to rules, but that is how it works today. And I have already before that have on the internet selected my dealers, father and son, Ankit, the son, and Keshab, the father, Dulal, who had the shop. Keshab Dulal had been collected the shalagramas for 30, 40 years or something, and had actually a quite huge collection of shalagramas. And he showed me some of his specimens. Here we have different types of shalagrams. They are defined both by the fossil proper, the chakra, and also by the cavities. This a shalagrama with such a huge cavity would often be identified with Narasimha due to the jaws, you know, there. And this one is one of the most precious because it has a double chakra. So that would often be identified with Lakshminarayan. And then from that, from Ankit Dulal, I bought five shalagrams, because the shalagrams can also be used as a panchayat and a puja set. So this shalagram is Shiva with this protrusion here, and this is is Vishnu. Why is it Vishnu? Because this is Vishnupada. Top left Vishnu with the Vishnupada, and top right Surya with the rays, the circle rays, and then bottom right Ganesh, the shape of the stone, and bottom left Ambika or Devi with this torso, presumably her breasts or something. So the identification is partly intuitive and partly by rules, traditional rules. So now I went on with Ankit, with Keshab. He was my guide when I went on to Muktinath, and here we are in Muktinath. and the kids, they collect shalagram stills and they sell them from the bazaar at the street. These are the ammonites fossils of the extinct Meron ammonoidae cephalopods. These mollusks created a chambered shell for protection, and it is the marks of the shell which typically distinguish the fossils. They are present in the Himalayan region as a result of the formation process of these mountains. Prior to the geological formation of the Himalaya, this area of the planet was part of the open Tethys Ocean. When the Indo-Australian tectonic plates, which have moved away from the Gondwana supercontinent of the southern hemisphere, collided with the Eurasian plate at the transition from the Upper Cretaceous to the Paleogene geological period, which is about 55 million years ago, sediments from the Tethys Ocean containing the remnants of its former animals were pushed up gradually to form the present-day mountains. So that's why this place is so rich in these fossils. It is the chakra pattern that more than anything else contributes to the ritual value of the stones. And the fuller the chakra, the more precious the shalagrama. But according to medieval text, even broken or damaged shalagramas are ritually efficacious if they have the marks of the chakra. This is the Muktinath temple. A lot of pilgrims from India come here, and this is the here we have Sri Muktinath with Sarasvati at the left and Lakshmi on the right. And I made friends with the priest at the place, Krishna Prasad Subedi, and one of the trusting managers, Rabin. Actually, there is an interesting conflict going on between Buddhist so-called nuns and the Hindu priests, because the temple is mostly visited by Hindu Vaishnavas, but the area is populated mostly by Buddhists. And the conflict is, of course, about donations from pilgrims. So there's only one Hindu in the trust, and the other are Buddhist, and they have a fight going on about keeping the temple as a Hindu temple, because some of the Buddhist so-called non, I'm a bit in doubt with what they actually were. They also perform not the full puja, but some if people come with prasad. These nuns will put it in front of the altar, and I was astonished because I didn't know that when I came, but I saw these women dressed in red, and I thought, what? That's not the style I know of from other temples. But then I had the explanation that is what is happening. These are Buddhist women who do some service, and inside the temple precinct, there is a hall where they have made a special altar with the shalagrams, where you can see how they have been anthropomorphized with facial features, including Vishnu's Urdhvapundra, the tilaka. And also here you can see the same with the tilaka mark and kumkum, etc. Then we did a river walk to try to collect them. This was just after monsoon, so it was a bit risky, so we didn't went that far. But we did actually find these fossils, and we could also pick them out from the sediments of the rocks some places. And this is my guide, Keshav. Moving on to Patna to find the Sonapatra. So as I told you, only these two stones, the Banalinga and the Shalagrama, are actually found at the original traditional places. When I came to Patna to find the Sonapatra, I didn't find it. I talked with many people, and they didn't really know about it. It is supposed to be collected at the Sangama between the Ganga, the Son, and the Gandaki. So three rivers meet at this spot near Patna, and then actually. The Son River has its source at Amarkantak, where also the Narmada river has its source. So actually all four rivers are more or less combined at this place. That makes it a special place, and it also tells us something that the ritual or the sacredness of the stones are related to these rivers. But actually the Son River is almost dried up. I should, of course, say some word about this. What we found was a skull, because when we walked down to the river, there were these cremation grounds. People tried to tell us, please don't go down there. But of course, we did that. So I didn't find it. Then I went on to find the Swarnamukhi, the Devi stone in Sri Kalahasti. This is also a famous pilgrimage town because of its Shiva temple in Andhra Pradesh. But I talked with priests of the temple and with puja shops and other shops, and people didn't really know about this, about these special crystals, these Swarnamukhi stones. I went, but actually I found some sources. Some old gazetteers who mentioned that the place had actually been a place for collecting quartz crystal, but that was not any longer the case, so it has been emptied. There was no stones left. I met this guy who explained me about the story. I think I've moved too fast. Yeah, here we are. No, this is This is the Spatica in Vellum, the Vellum town, which I was talking about. Yeah, and he explained me that that actually there has been a collection of quartz crystal, but it's no longer possible. Then finally, I got to Chennai and made some interviews with some of the people from this kind of Samartha Brahmins, and I was lucky enough to be able to visit this very kind couple, Mr. and Mrs. Atreya, in Chennai in October. And this is the puja. This was performed at the end of the Navaratri. So therefore, Devi has been placed in the center, but not in her stone form and not in her anthropomorphic form, but as a Sri Yantra. But please note that she has been coupled with a small linga, so Shiva and Shakti are always together. And here we have Vishnu, the Shalagram, and here we have again Shiva and Shakti together. This is the Swarnamukhi stone, Devi, but placed here because the Sri Yantra is in the center. But she is placed together with Shiva, so always Shiva and Shakti together, and Ganesh as the stone. And then, of course, because of the Navaratri, we have the Devi also here, beautifully dressed in blue, at the end of the altar. And as you can see, there is this specific Smarta relationship with Vedanta. This is Shankara, and then also the three icons of Neo Vedanta, with Ramakrishna, Vivekananda, and Sri Sarada Devi, and other Vedanta images. So this in this family, the ritual is performed in the traditional way. I was attending this performance, and it is a very open thing. People can come and they will recite a lot of shlokas at the recitation. And at this occasion, I recognized shlokas from the Devi Mahatmya being recited. But other, for instance, these young people who these Brahmin couples who are initiated, they don't necessarily have the stones transmitted from the father, so they have to buy it from shops like this, the Giri Trading. Note the slogan: Giri Trading, the one shop for all your divine needs. It's a very huge shop, and it's a chain of shops. But I have this idea that the main shop, the main office in Chennai, in Mylapore. I will also like to tell you about the, because there are many aspects of this ritual, and one of the interesting aspects is the revitalizations, the revival of the ritual among this group. Why is it revived? What is going on? This is also the shop. At this initiation ceremony, and you can note, of course, the date, 15 August, this is the Independence Day, and as you saw in the first pictures, it was in front of the national flag. So the group have the idea that the revival of this ritual will be part of, will be a help for the nation in some way. It has a national implication. These boxes with the five stones were all blessed by the senior and junior Shankaracharya from the Kanchi Math. And here they are inspected, and here they are blessed, for the surrounding community, this is a bit controversial, because the Kanchi Math has been through many years of trial, have been accused of criminal activities and corruption and things like that. So there are a lot of controversies around Kanchi Math, and therefore also about how these rituals are blessed in this way. So this person, Sharma Shastrigal, who is the initiator to all this, He's very active in this kind of reintroduction. But some of the background for this is the political situation and the social situation specific to Tamil Nadu, because Brahmins in Tamil Nadu are under pressure from political anti-Brahmanism and what some of them themselves label as the westernization of the youth. The South Indian caste system is different from what we know from the North. It is divided in three. We have the Brahmins, we have the Shudras and the Untouchables, traditionally. But around the start of the 20th century, a Dravidian and anti-Brahmin movement started to mobilize and gain influence. In 1914, Tamil legislators decided to rename the former Untouchables as Adi Dravidians, and the Shudra class was also renamed as non-Brahmins. Former Brahmin privileges were cancelled and the Brahmin class lost influence and status in the society. In 1925, the Tamil social reformer E.V. Ramasamy founded the Self-Respect Movement. It was later transformed into the Dravidian Karagam DK, the Dravidian Federation, the aim of which was not only to eradicate caste and untouchability, but also to establish a separate Dravidian nation for the Tamil-speaking area of South India. It was an activist movement with a militant anti-Brahmin agenda. Its activities during the 1950s to 70s, including campaigns where members forcibly cut off the topknots and sacred threads of male Brahmins, which of course are two traditional visible markers of Brahmin identity. The movement developed into the present political parties, the DMK and the AIA-DMK. According to Chris Fuller and Haripriya Narayan Singhan's 2014 book, Tamil Brahmins, The Making of a Middle Class Caste, the two parties have expanded the reservation system greatly during the shifting periods of governance. Quote, so that Brahmins are vastly outnumbered by non-Brahmins at all levels of the government and service and public sector. The dominance of non-Brahmin values in Tamil public life is also reflected in the low support in Tamil Nadu to the Hindu nationalist BJP, which only won 2.8% of the votes at the latest election in 2016. In contrast, BJP won the majority, that is almost 40%, in the northern state of Uttar Pradesh during the latest election in that state. So there are very huge differences between north and south. Salma Shastrikal is a religious authority figure with a large group of followers amongst Marathi Brahmins in Chennai, as well on Facebook, where he is followed by more than 7,000 persons. So it is characteristic of this court of traditionalism that it is not against modernity. Actually, it is modern in the way it uses mass media, for instance. But still, it wants to emphasize the traditions. And so it's typical for this movement that he published a kind of a how-to book. So that's of course. For Salma Shastrikal, however, the promotion of the Pachayana Puja is only part of a larger agenda of revitalizing traditional Brahmin values and lifestyle in Tamil Nadu, an agenda that has been articulated more fully in his book, The Great Hindu Tradition. The book is organized as a Hindu how-to book with instructions for traditional dress, rituals and the use of modern communication devices, like the cell phone, in manners acceptable from the point of view of traditional religious values. The need for how-to books is of course symptomatic of the situation, and in a sense paradoxical, because traditionally a traditional lifestyle in dress, manners and rituals would be passed on from generation to generation through close family ties. But it is not so today. Traditions are no longer tied to the family exclusively as a matter of course, and the family is no longer a guarantee of their transmission. While religious identity is still mediated through the material forms of certain lifestyles, the authority of transmission is no longer located exclusively in the family. Instead, transmission processes are mediatized in a broader and more open framework via how-to manuals, for instance, and the task has changed from one of maintenance of traditional identity to a rebuilding of lost group identities or the construction of new ones. Interestingly, the contemporary traditionalism among Smarta Brahmins is thus not anti-modern. It embraces modern communication media and techniques, but it negotiates the scope of their use and especially the content that they make available. Priests answer their cell phones as much as others, even during temple service, but at the same time, they are confronted with new problems. And these are some scans from the book. Veda mantra and ringtone. Question. Can I have a Veda mantra on my ringtone in my mobile? Answer. No, it is not advisable. Instead, please choose some sloka to this purpose. And in the same vein, Valentine Days. Question. What are your views on celebrating Valentine Days? This is clearly addressed at the young generation of this kind of westernization. And the answer, the very concept of Valentine Days is absurd. Young minds have been polluted and misguided into making this barbaric practice an acceptable one. Elders object to it primarily because it propagates permissive behavior that is alien to our culture. And similarly with birthday parties. Question. Celebrating birthday parties has these days become a way of life. What do you feel about this? Answer. If you feel that you should celebrate the birthday, please do not follow the Western culture in doing so. You can go to a temple and devote yourself to prayer for your well-being. Especially the practice of blowing out candles is reprehensible to our Dharma. We believe in lighting lamps to celebrate something, not putting them out. And then it is also symptomatic that even clothing has to be instructed, and especially the use of the panchakacham, how do you pronounce this? Panchakacham?
Kacham.
Which is a certain way of binding the dhoti or the veshti. It's called veshti in Tamil.
Veshti.
And a large, huge instruction how to do it. It is actually not so easy because it's difficult to make it stick. I tried it several times, but there is a technique. But it is symptomatic that such instructions have to be given. It is not it is not taken for granted how to do this. And there is, of course, a whole sociology of this veshti, of this dhoti, the colors, the length of it, the way it is folded. All these things indicate certain social status and group associations, etc. Okay, I have a couple of minutes left. Yeah, of course, this group and Sharma Shastra group is quite conservative. Here, Arya Dravida race theory, he opposed, of course, the Western scientific explanation of the this so-called Aryan invasion, and opposed that. And also, there is some quite strong affiliations with Sangh Parivar, the Hindu nationalist movements, for instance, with the RSS. He praises Golwalkar, who started the RSS, and he did work together with him, etc. I'm not sure I have any more. And also, I mean, yeah, I think I will. So this group is. I'm not sure how special it is actually. I'm not sure how widespread this kind of traditionalism is in this area. But among that group which I was studying, it was quite explicit. So yeah, I think I will stop here.
Thank you. So questions and responses.
We can return to some of the points of the Puja, if you like, or other points, if you want some more explanations.
Did you engage with any of the younger people who were exposed?
No, I didn't have I didn't have the occasion to talk with them. But I noticed that young should be in quotations mark, because if you look at the pictures of this these 108 couples, they were quite they were not so young. I mean, but it is in the rhetoric. In the rhetoric, there is this concern about the young generation and how they dress and what they watch on TV and things like that. And it is, this is not only in South. I have experienced the same in Varanasi, which of course is not typical. This is a very special city. But I have overheard conversations between, I think, teachers from the university, from the Banaras Hindu University, saying things like, oh, the young generation, they don't know Sanskrit, they don't know Dharma, etc., you know, like that. This kind of sentiments.
Is that kind of re-traditionalization fighting a lost cause, do you think?
Yeah, I think so in Tamil. We have an expert here, but I have the sense that the political situation is a big part of the explanation, actually. But this place...
It's sort of anti-Hindu sentiment in Tamil Nadu, yeah. which is quite unusual because there's so many temples and a lot of
exactly.
temples. So it's like a... You know, you don't expect it's like a
paradox. No, it's an ambivalent, because there's a great pride of the huge temple, the beautiful temple complexes. At that same time, the Brahmins are sort of marginalized. But this special area in Chennai, the Mylapore, the demographic is different. There are quite a big number of Brahmin families in that area. So that is also why there's a kind of enclave with these political affiliations, etc., at that place. Yeah.
The Varna lingas and the Shatagram were kind of very much connected to the place.
Yeah.
But you mentioned that the others, there's no local tradition. So where did they get them?
Yeah. Well, that was what I really wanted to find out, because previously I had done the study with the Varna lingas. I actually got to know. The whole process, how they were produced, how they were collected earlier, and I wanted to follow up on that. But unfortunately, as it sometimes is with fieldwork, my time was too short. I wanted to interview the shop, the giri trading, ask them, where do we get the stone from? But, you know, then there was the barrier of you know, business secrets and things like that. But my guess, and I think it's quite a relevant guess, is that like the Varna linga production has adjusted to changes in the environment, the distribution process has also adjusted to modern distribution networks. So I guess that giri trading, which is a very professional puja shop chain, that they actually get the stone from professional gem dealers. And I think most of the gem, or many of the gem, are collected actually or mined in Rajasthan, I think, many of them, some perhaps other places, but certainly not on those places which were supposed to traditionally. But then also I have to say that when I talked to people, they were not worried about that, because their theological affiliation is with Vedanta, and then they say to me, you know, well, what does the form matter? It's only a form. And I had some very funny talks with some of them, saying, you know, that we can worship God in anything. It can be a dog. It can even be Mr. Akta, you know, and things like that. And so they're not disturbed by this.
Do they have a tradition also of markings on those?
No, this is the marking and the facial features on the shalagrams and the balalinga is only on rituals, specific Vaishnava rituals and specific Shaiva rituals, whereas in the Panchayana Puja they will not be decorated in this way. They will be giving kumkum and like in the puja, but they will not be added with facial decoration.
So there's no tradition
about
the Ganesh stones?
No. So I have the idea that the iconicity is actually stronger in the Panchayana Puja than in the Vaishnava and Shaiva contexts. especially the Shalagrama, is very often decorated with these facial features.
Final quick question. The text for where the description of the wandering, I got too late at the end, but the source of that, did I see that correctly as Chaturvarga Chintamani?
You can just a moment, let's find it. It was come on. It has to reload, yeah. Let us see. Do you mean this text? Oh, sorry. This is from Chaturvarga Chintamani. Yeah. And this is, you can find similar instructions in other texts. Some of the Shilpa Shastras also have definitions like this. And this, and the principle is the same with the Shalagramas, to correlate the visual specifics of the stones with specific iconographic features. And of course, with the Shalagramas, the number of possibilities is much larger, because they use all the avatars, and all the different iconographic aspects of the avatars are included in these definitions. And these guys from the Pashupatarabharasa, they're quite trained in these definitions. For instance, at the Ankit and Keshav's shop, you know, they have huge bookshelf with these Puranas and all these texts which they are trained in. But also I noticed when I asked him about certain stones that there is also a kind of intuitive way of sometimes it is a bit contradictory. One day it will be this aspect of a god, and the other day would be another, so it can change a little.
I'm curious about the overlap between Tantrism and Smartism.
Yeah.
It seems to be a hotspot. That's a lot of imaginary community and mental tradition, but a real imaginary, which is a real mental tradition.
Yeah.
And to my advice, I came across the Pachacharya in Nepal with many of the yogis that interviewed the gurus.
Okay.
And not yogis, but especially I was surprised to find them with the gurus.
Of course.
And they would sometimes have the standard Shalagramas. Sometimes they would all be from Nepal. So there would be a ratio to Nepal as a Asian binary together.
Yeah.
And they would adapt it, interpret it in their context, worshipping the stones. When Baba Kali Baba from Tilkut, he would round off the ritual by throwing a red hibiscus in the middle of the Pachayaki. So this orienting it all towards the Shakti orientation. But I thought it might be an adaption. I went to the point to find some of the old tradition preserved there. But they would adapt something like the Shalagrama,
yes,
I think, and tune it into
to
link themselves with kind of nation understanding. Was my initial thesis.
I think you're right, because the Panchayanputra is also a kind of a travel kit. It's handy because you have it in a box and you can have it with you. So that would fit the Akoris, the way of life. But I think there is a break of the rules, because according to the rule, the five deities are on an equal footing. Of course, families can have a predilection for one god or another, but to exclusively interpret it in a Shakta way would be a break of the tradition, I think.
In
the central area.
You should have one picture with a Sri Lanka in the middle.
So there is some kind of merging or some blending. I would like to show you that picture again. The picture you were talking about. Wait a moment. It's not there. We have to go. Move on, because I was a bit in doubt about this, what I was telling you. I'm not sure I was correct about saying that this coupling of Shiva and Shakti, That was my idea, but actually I'm a bit uncertain, because this am I correct, do you think, in that this is a linga?
Yes, it's one of this.
It must be a linga, isn't it?
A mini linga.
Yeah, a mini linga. Because this fits with what I, when I interviewed priests in Varanasi, I had the luck to be able to interview one of the priests from the Vishwanath, Kashi Vishwanath, and he very much emphasized all the time the necessity of having Shiva and Shakti always united together. And this is the same idea we have here, where there's Shiva, there's Shakti.
And that's a characteristic of Tantra.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Because this way of positioning the stone is not according to the manuals. They should not be put together in that way. No, I don't think so. No, I don't think so. But I think rather it has become a blend, like, you know, a natural kind of normal way of blending things.
I think the same would go for the Agurus, they were not considered smart.
No, of course not.
Did you see the Shaiva mugs and Shringeri?
No, not Shringeri. No, I didn't. Not yet. This is another trick.
They always have the Aderu, they have tantric practices.
They have, right?
In Advaita mugs.
Okay.
So they always have a
Meru
chakra
there. Mm-hmm. I also want to say that it's very similar actually for Meru arrangement.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's
And many of my relations do Sri Chakra Puja, but they're Advaitins.
Oh. Do you know if the same in Kanchimath?
Yeah, I think
it's the same. Okay.
Yes.
And it's very similar arrangement, and because it's a standard 16 Upacharas Puja, as you told, it's nothing special if we don't consider as a speciality that they use stones.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it is really necessary to see on this Puja for Meru and Meru arrangement, which is very, very similar.
Where did you see that?
Oh, I saw it in many places, in Benares, and it's in Tamil Nadu, yes, in Kalahasti, I think.
Tamil Nadu, it's very, Sri Chakra Puja, with Advaita, the Smartha Brahmins.
Okay.
There is a connection, I don't know why, but there is
I think it should have some connection with pilgrimage practice.
Yeah, maybe because it's a travel kit.
It is, yes. It's not only because it's a travel kit, but even collecting these stones.
You're right.
It's necessary to establish this link or to at least to study it.
Because it has this pan-Indian structure, like
so
the pilgrimage places.
Yes,
yeah.
So not only just to collect this, to visit all these places, and so it might be so.
But that fits very well with the Smarta tradition of, you know, uniting the whole of India, you know, with the pilgrimage places.
Yes,
with the different
some kind of cosmos, some kind of universe, which is
in
organizing through the pilgrimage and collecting all the stones all together.
Yeah.
And so it might be so. Yeah. It's necessary just to investigate and to study. And I have, if it's possible, one more short question. During puja, when they donate some gift, food and all other things, they put it in any particular place, how they put it? Because you see, it is five stones. If they put it somewhere closer to one stone...
I didn't get the question, please.
Where they put food or milk or whatever,
they use you know, puffed rice, a small item that they will just...
All together, not any particular place,
At each stone? Yes.
Okay.
And then they will pour water on the stone, that's why you have the you know, they can pour down, and there's a tray underneath which will collect the water.
And is it any particular order? They start from the center or from right, left?
Yes, that depends on the predilection, which deity in the center. They will start from the center and then they will move. This is the Devi Panchayat in Puja. I'm not completely certain that this positioning is according to the rules of how to position that the stones according to the Devi, but I would think that it will be like this, and this. But I'm not sure.
This, you mean?
No, no, we can see that. I would guess that it's clockwise, but I'm not sure on that.
If it is clockwise, it
you start with Ganesha, but who do you have in the center?
We have Shiva.
You have Shiva in the center. You would start with Ganesh. Okay, that's another order than the way it's positioned. Okay. But that's the logical, because Ganesh always with me first. Okay.
So it might have some connection with Lokapalas.
Mm-hmm.
Central part and reactions. So yes, it is exactly. Definitely present here, and it's another pattern which is necessary to study in connection with this
Well, unfortunately, I have to catch my flight to Copenhagen, so I think we need to stop here. But it has been, I'm very happy to have the great occasion to present this.
Thank you so much for sharing your work with us. This is great. We hope to see you back again soon.
Surely.
Thank you.
Thank you.